Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. When we think about conservation, generally speaking, I think we concentrate on that thing that we are trying to protect. But that leaves out a big part of the conservation puzzle, and that is us, the human part. How do we teach people to care about the environment? How do we balance human needs with the needs of the planet? How is it that perhaps knowing ourselves better helps us know non-human animals and think about what their experiences are like? Those are some of the questions that we'll try to take up here in this part of the show. And our guest for the program is Dr. Laura Kim Joyner. She is a veterinarian, doctor of veterinary medicine, who has a special interest in birds and avian medicine and conservation. She's worked in a number of countries as a consultant on those in those areas, avian medicine conservation, with a particular emphasis on parrot conservation. She is a clinical instructor and research assistant professor at the Non-Domestic Avian Clinic at the College of Vet Medicine at North Carolina State University. In addition, she is also an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister and also became a certified trainer in nonviolent communication. She served in parish ministry for 10 years. She's the director of Lefebvre Conservation and Wildlife and One Earth Conservation, and currently has parrot conservation projects going in Guatemala, in Honduras, and in Nicaragua, and does a lot of writing and lecturing on subjects like compassionate conservation and the human dimensions of conservation. She's visiting the campus. She gave a talk last night. A number of sponsors, including the Wildlife Medical Clinic at the U of I College of Vet Medicine. And we're very happy that she could be here and spend some time with us for this hour of the Focus. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like, you can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. That is the address. And any point here, people can join in the conversation. Thank you very much for being here.
That's great. Thank you for having me.
I'm really interested in just as a way of starting to explore your background a little bit, to take a couple of steps back before talking about human dimensions and conservation. And just let me ask you, at what point in your life did you decide that you wanted to be a veterinarian?
I recall being 4 years old looking for veterinary school so I could become a wild bird veterinarian. It was something that was just a part of what I wanted to do, and I went straight away to do that, hoping to work with the wild birds.
Yeah. So why? What was it about? I mean, obviously birds are beautiful and mysterious, and maybe that's no big surprise that somebody would want to work with wild birds. Was there something in particular, some particular experience that you had?
There wasn't that I can identify. I dreamt in birds as a small child. They were my nightmares. They were my dreams. And so there was just something about it. Our family wasn't particularly into birds, but I would spend my childhood walking through the woods talking and singing to the birds. So that's either nutso, or as a minister, I can say it's a gift of grace to be so called to be with a group of beings that need our help.
Sure.
And so it's a gift.
Was there something that particularly got you interested in, say, tropical birds and the kind of things that you've done research work on?
I believe that the pull is there's much work to do with parrots. They're the most endangered group of birds are the parrots. One-third of them are endangered, and they exist in very impoverished areas and high biodiverse areas. So there's a lot of very needed work. And so I accidentally really specialized in tropical parrots.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I suppose people who know those birds would also say that they're some of the most interesting, some of the smartest birds, and can display some of the most interesting and complicated behaviors probably of any bird that you're going to run into.
They're pretty smart. What is it, Alex, the African gray parrot? They put around 4 years of age of an intelligence, and some of the crows and magpies might be even more.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, and so then let me go out and ask the next thing. So you're a veterinarian, you're particularly interested in birds and had done this kind of conservation work. And so what led you to become an ordained minister?
It was not the plan. I'll just put it that way. I eventually moved to Guatemala to do my frontline conservation work back in the 90s and in the 80s. And that was the time of the guerrilla warfare. There was a lot of violence and poverty in the area we were working in. And I realized as a trained veterinarian, I didn't have the tools that were going to save the birds because the people were in such trouble. You really needed to pay attention to the people and have the in social and emotional intelligence, the spiritual gifts, you need to have some kind of inner resources to do that really hard work. And I didn't have them. And so I just sort of stumbled into auditing a class in theology when I was a professor of avian medicine. And I said, that's the language. That's what I need to learn as a tool to supplement my work as a veterinarian, to go back into these really hard areas, because we need to heal the human heart if we're going to save this planet.
Yeah. So then it seems pretty obvious that your approach to the idea of conservation is informed by, is shaped by this spirit, a thing I guess I would call, for want of a better word, this spiritual dimension.
Yeah, that's a tricky word, the word spiritual. You know, probably every listener out there has got a different understanding for it. I'll say it another way, and maybe we'll get that. Always when I was a veterinarian, I was almost as interested in the well-being of the people I worked with as with the birds. And so what I came to learn, that the health of all is, of us is interconnected, and so maybe if we call that spirit or not, and that people are beautiful, and yet we're really hard to work with. So To be a minister, boy, howdy, do you learn how to work with difficult people. And that's what I learned, is how can I actualize the beauty I feel for people and the love I feel? How can I actually tolerate to work with them in very difficult areas to save the birds? And I think we people need to see our beauty and work with our tools of who we are. And we don't have a lot of training in that, from veterinarians to psychologists to radio interviewers.
Yeah. Well, and I'll go over and maybe you can talk about human dimensions of conservation. And I think, I guess as I started thinking about this, the thing I thought the place to set it up was kind of as I did in trying to introduce you in the conversation and saying something like, well, you know, when you talk about conservation, we're focusing on something. We're focusing on an ecosystem. We're focusing on a plant. We're focusing on the animal. You know, we're focusing on the thing that we're trying to save, which completely ignores the fact that you got to take into consideration the animal that has the greatest impact on the environment. That's the human animal, the human being, and the way that we interact with the environment and what we do every day and how we live. You can't do the one thing without considering the other, but I'm not always sure that we really actually do. Take the human part into consideration.
You sure have got it. I loved your introduction about how you captured that. And when I went to veterinary school and got into conservation, there really was an understanding that we paid attention to the humans. You just watch the birds, you take care of the birds, and you tell people to not poach them or shoot them or cut down the forest. There wasn't a lot of tolerance or teaching. And nowadays, when you go to conservation conferences or read books, it's all about the people, and you don't really see, and I'm over-exaggerating here, but you don't really see pictures of animals, because we need to work with this. And an article just came out in Bioscience last week that said that the underlying issue in our biodiverse areas is poverty. And so I've become very political through my ministry and also as a veterinarian, because we need a fundamental overview or overhaul of the way we distribute resources, because with poverty, we cannot protect our biodiverse areas. People have to be able to sustain themselves in the good life if we are to keep parrots and forest and oxygen on this planet.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that people here in industrial countries, we hope people are thinking about the way that they live having some impact on the global environment. But we're talking about, say, a conservation effort that takes place, say, as the things that you've done in the Philippines, in Latin America, that they're really, what you're talking about is this intimate connection between environment and people who are just trying to survive.
Yeah.
And for them, you know, maybe thinking environmentally might at one level seem to be a luxury that they can't quite afford.
And, you know, I know we often think about that, and every culture is different, every group of people. So I really can't say people without a lot of resources. But they do value birds and their environment in their particular cultural context. So instead of going in and saying they're going to poach birds because they need the economic resources, that's not the question we come in. We come in with, how do you value birds, and how do you use those birds to give meaning to your life? It's the same questions we ask ourselves here. And then we listen to their responses, and then they come up with ideas of how they can live the good life, because they also want their birds to stay on the planet. They very much do so. It's just in very different ways than we might prescribe ahead of time.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can talk some more about, in more concrete terms, about the work that you've done with parrots and conservation in Latin America.
Sure. And as I mentioned, I lived in Guatemala during the guerrilla warfare years. And, oh my gosh, there's so many projects. But the one that I can lift up as an example, I work with the indigenous people in Honduras, in La Mosquitia. And so they have their own language and their own culture. And the last remaining 150 scarlet macaws in Honduras are now in their area, because it's sort of one of the last wild areas where they can protect them. And the people's way of life is very threatened. They have death threats. The narcotic trade is in there. It's a very poor country, the second poorest in Latin America. And these indigenous people don't want to be forced off their land, and they're being forced off their lands with assassinations and robberies. They also don't want to lose their scarlet macaws. So they realize that they can't survive without the parrots, and so they want to do the work to protect their parrots. So the work that I do is to go into areas that are really having a hard time and support the people that they are beautiful, that their values matter. They have autonomy. I respect them. How can I be in solidarity with their work? And so I can do that by bringing veterinary expertise. I can write. I can go public speaking. I can help with grants to help these people take a stand. And in just the 2 years we've been in Honduras, the people have come back to a village. They had to flee because of an assassination attempt on their elders there. And they are making a stand, and it's being centered around the parrots. But it's really about keeping their way of life, too. And I love that intersection, that we don't survive without the parrots.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting to think about so many cases where pressure is put on animals, that it's a big issue is loss of habitat. For whatever reason, their native environment is being lost, and a lot of times I suppose it's lost to development. Mm-hmm. But here it almost makes you think that for the human beings, habitat loss is an issue as well. And you know, maybe it's a different kind of set of pressures, but that's the same kind of thing.
Wow, that's nice. That's nice and intuitive. I'm smiling to hear you talk about that, because when you have impoverished areas, the first beings to take the hardest hits are children, and then women generally, and animals. So if people aren't doing well, that's where you're going to find animals in extinction and suffering as well. And if you have the greater the income gap between, the haves and have-nots, the 1%, 90%, the greater extreme environmental issues you're going to see. We are all in this together.
Mm. Well, let me reintroduce again for everybody who's just tuned in, our guest for this hour, Dr. Laura Kim Joyner. She is a veterinarian, a doctor of veterinary medicine, who's particularly interested in avian medicine. So that's birds we're talking about, avian medicine and conservation. She's done a lot of work in the Philippines and Latin America. She is currently director of Lefebvre Conservation and director of One Earth Conservation. She is adjunct professor at North Carolina State University College of Veterinary Medicine. She is also an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister and does a lot of work in this particular area. She's done a lot of work on parrot conservation in Latin America, some of the work that she's talked about, and is particularly interested in this whole subject of human dimensions of conservation. She's visiting the campus, gave a talk last night, and we're pleased that she could be here. Questions and comments certainly from people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk some more about the human dimensions of conservation. I guess one thing I'm sort of interested in is one of the things that people who work in conservation and bring different disciplines to it, not just people who are wildlife biologists, I suppose, but also the psychologists and anthropologists and sociologists and so forth, is how do you make the pitch to people that thinking ecologically makes sense? You know, how do you persuade people that even here where I'm living in central Illinois, so why should I really be so concerned about Honduran parrots? I mean, really?
Or even maybe about their own whooping cranes that
well,
come through
okay.
here.
Well, okay, that even closer. There are certain things to be concerned about. That's even closer to home than much closer to home than Honduran parrots. That maybe is a better way of framing the question, I suppose.
Well, I just wanted to maybe have the listeners go, why would I care about parrots? Right, I could do an argument there, but you know, maybe we could come closer to home. Yeah. You know, I'm always hesitant to try to persuade people. You know, I want to ask where they are and have them do a self-discovery. You know, what do I think about a whooping crane? I also believe that part of that convincing is just to give them the opportunity to explore belonging on this planet, having a sense of interconnection on this planet, a sense of beauty, and out of their own experience and what their body knows, they can come to the realization that we're all in it together. Some of this is also just environmental education and understandings of principles of ecology. For instance, if the whooping cranes aren't going to make it, that means we've lost the swamps and the bayous and we've spilled oil down in Louisiana and Florida with the Gulf oil spill, and the people can't fish and the cranes can't exist. So I believe that we're becoming to learn it's a paradigm shift that humans are animals and we are not separate from everybody else and our health is interrelated. It's a tough sell because you and I and most people in this country didn't come out of that awareness.
We have a caller. Let's talk with them. Someone on a cell phone. They're calling from Watsika. That's our first caller on our line number four. Hello.
Yeah, David, thanks. Great show. Very provocative. I'm listening to the show, and from what your guest said, a thought just came into my mind, and maybe she could comment on it. You mentioned that if people aren't doing well in an environment, then the animals aren't. And for some reason, what came to my mind was, historically speaking, the expansion of the West, and when the Indians were being forced out of their habitat, the complete and utter destruction for absolutely no reason at all of the buffalo, and the effects that had on their environment and eventually on ours. But that's just a comment, a commentary. But my thought would be, I can't see this thing being turned around. I appreciate your efforts, and maybe we can stop it where it is. But don't you think it has to do with just the over excess of the human being on this planet, that at some point something has to give? And I'm hoping that it's not too late, but I'm just wondering if, you know, we can never get back to where we were, and hopefully it's not too late. So I'll make those two comments and leave it up to your guest to comment any way she wants. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Well,
okay, let's try to do that. I really appreciate the example of the indigenous people here in North America and the buffalo. That brings it to what many of us experience, and I think you just nailed that on the head. There's a primary example. Another one that I lift up is that we used to have a parrot in this country, the Carolina parakeet, that would go all the way up over to Nebraska and up to New York, and we lost that bird, and we lost it as we were losing the indigenous people, mostly in the southeast of this country. So, yes, those are really, really great examples. And I think looking at how much we've lost in this country is where your next question, I believe you're asking, is do we stand a chance? Can we turn this around given who we are as a species and what we lost? And I can't predict the future. So, I'm not a pie-in-the-sky optimist. But what I have learned and what I try to teach people is, yes, we have the capacity to compete and destruct, but we also have incredible physiology to collaborate and to change our brains and to change our behavior. We just have to be smart about it. And it's very encouraging news, the recent research in interpersonal neurobiology. I'm very impressed with it. My life has changed a great deal from viewing some of these principles. So I'm not ready to give up yet. Will we do it in time? I don't know, but there is a sense of urgency. And I think it behooves all of us to be the change we want to be in the world if we're going to save what we want.
Just, and I'm curious because you talked about the Carolina parakeet. Was that a bird that became extinct? Was it hunted to extinction, or was that habitat loss that was the big issue?
A lot of the issues, and of course it's in historical, so we didn't have a chance to really study it. But the pieces that they feel is that the birds were somewhat of an agricultural pest, even though in their last stand in Florida they were not considered an agricultural pest. They were hunted for pets and for adornment for their feathers.
Ah.
And they were hunted just because we liked to shoot things. It was a kind of a different culture in those times. And in recent years, they feel that the last remaining populations were taken out from museum collectors, zoo collections, and possibly exotic poultry disease got into the last remaining populations in Florida.
Yeah.
So it was us that did it.
Yeah. Well, I guess I asked the question just because there are good examples of both things. That is, before there were environmental laws, we had market gunning in this country, and so a lot of birds were hunted, were just shot into extinction. But then there are also notable cases where we think pretty much what the issue is like habitat loss, like the ivory-billed woodpecker. That probably, it wasn't because people shot it. It was because it has a very specific niche, and we seem to have lost that niche, although I guess there are still people who think maybe somewhere hiding out there are some ivory bills, but the effort to try to find them has, so far, I think, hasn't really been very successful after a little burst of excitement about the possibility that they might still be around.
Right, and so another piece that you point out is the habitat loss is extreme in some cases, but every species is different. So we ask all those questions. Some, it's got nothing to do with habitat. It's got because of the pet bird trade. Like in Mesoamerica and Central America, the habitat loss in some areas is really extreme, but the pressure of nearly 100% poaching on some of these species, poaching meaning they take all the chicks out, there are no replacement birds for these populations. So in that case, they could deal with the habitat loss, but because of the poaching, they cannot. And I want to lift up the ivory-billed woodpecker, the passenger pigeon, the Carolina parakeet, those are sad stories, the buffalo. But look at what the bald eagle has done. They're now hunting in neighborhoods. They hunt. Oh, I see them flying over the pool I swim at. They have come back. The peregrine falcon has come back. The whooping crane has come back. The Puerto Rican parrot in Puerto Rico has come back. So we can do this.
Yeah. Well, although it's interesting, I think with some of those examples, you wonder, was it that we did it so much as they did it? And they figured out how to live with us. It wasn't quite so much the other way around. Although it's certainly very important that laws were passed to protect them so that people couldn't go out and hurt them or hunt them. But part of it, I wonder whether indeed it has to do with they've figured out how they can adapt to living around humans.
Yeah, how smart are we? Are we totally in control? Let's not give ourselves all the credit.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, the animal behavior, I think it's difficult because there you know, there's only so much you can do to look into the head of another animal. Sometimes human behavior maybe can give you some sort of insight, but there's a hesitance. You have to be kind of careful to say, well, because I think this and because I feel this, well, that probably must mean that the animal does too. Sometimes that may be a little bit of a reasonable seeming leap. On the other hand, you know, it's a leap. I wonder what you can say about how over time we have thought about animal behavior and, in fact, you know, to what extent it's reasonable to take human behavior, human psychology, and apply that to non-human animals.
It's a great question, and it has been somewhat controversial over the years. How can we be objective about subjective areas such as what another species is thinking? And the way I often respond to this is, we don't even know what we're thinking in our own minds. The neuroscience is telling us that how much of our decisions and our behavior is motivated by emotions and subconscious thought. And after we do a certain behavior, our frontal cortex, our thinking part of the brain, is making up a story about why we did it. So we are at best guessing at why I came and did this radio show this morning. We don't even know. So we can't even do it with human beings, let alone to cross the species divide. So I just want to throw that out. But the new field, relatively new field of cognitive ethology, of studying what animals are thinking and feeling, has gotten more rigorous. And we can do studies. We just have to think about how to ask the questions. Mm-hmm. And we are able to do it. But the old paradigm says they don't think and they don't feel. And because we're losing that as a paradigm, saying animals are on a continuum of thinking and feeling and mentation, we are actually learning that we were quite wrong in the past about what was going on in non-human animal lives.
Yeah. Well, it seems sort of hard to understand why it is we were so unwilling to say, well, you know, we're animals, okay, we're human animals, and we think and we feel, and we understand that, although we may not understand one another all that well. But we know that. Why was it such an unreasonable thing to think that if that applies to us, that it wouldn't apply to non-human animals? Mm-hmm. That if you step on my foot, I'll go ow. If I step on my cat's foot, he'll go ow. Well, so why do we somehow think that that's not the same thing? But it seemed like for a long time, we did actually think, oh no, those are two completely different things.
Yeah, that's right. In veterinary school, when I went to school 25 years ago, we weren't given much instruction in pain management. You know, the dog is howling coming out of anesthesia and surgery. Well, that's just what dogs do. Well, no, they're hurting and very much like human beings. So you're kind of asking, where did that cultural construct, where did we get that idea that humans are so separate and different from non-human animals? And of course, depending on the culture, you can point to the stories we told about why we thought we were so fundamentally different, that they're not our kin, they're not our brothers and sisters. And depending on the culture, you could point out perhaps, and I don't want to pick on any religious tradition, but our cultural stories, our indigenous stories, our religious stories say that in some cases, God chose us, or we developed because we think and we are closer to angels than our animals. And various kinds of stories like this, we were just trying to make sense of our world. We didn't know how to deal with our animal selves and our human selves. So we told these stories to say, we're better, we're different. This is why we die. This is why there's life after death. And all of those stories that we made up maybe helped us feel better and get our work done and live together, but it made us grow more distance from the animals around us, made us hard to understand. Evolution connects us through heart and thinking to the beings around us.
Well, in this part of the show, we're talking about human dimensions of conservation. Our guest is veterinarian Dr. Laura Kim Joyner. She's visiting the campus, and we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week. And let me just mention that in hour two, we'll be talking with Robert Trivers. He's an anthropologist at Rutgers University, very well known for his work in the area of evolutionary biology. So that involves trying to look at behaviors and ask this question, well, are those behaviors, do they have some kind of survival value? Is that why they are there? And we'll talk about a very interesting subject that he's written a book about. We'll be talking about deceit and self-deception, about the fact that not only do human beings lie to each other, we lie to ourselves. And he says, in fact, there is survival value in being able to lie to yourself. He writes about this in his new book, The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Life. That's in the 11 o'clock hour today. And then Wednesday at 11, the guest is Michael Grabel. He's a journalist, reporter with ProPublica, and we'll be taking a look at the federal stimulus plan that went into effect to try to pull the country out of the big decline after the financial collapse. And he's written a book about this, taking a look at the stimulus and essentially asking the question, well, did that work? What was the effect? The title of his book is Money Well Spent. That's with a question mark. Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the $1 trillion Stimulus, the Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. That's Wednesday at 11. I think that means tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics for every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. You can check the schedule by going to the website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. In this part of the show, we're talking with Dr. Laura Kim Joyner. She is a veterinarian who specializes in birds and has done a lot of work as a consultant in avian medicine and conservation, with particular emphasis on parrot conservation. She is involved in work in Latin America, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua. She's director of Lefebvre Conservation and Wildlife and One Earth Conservation. She is also an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister, certified trainer in nonviolent communication. She served in parish ministry for 10 years. And in addition, she is also adjunct professor at North Carolina State University College of Veterinary Medicine. visiting the campus here. Some folks brought her here to give a talk, among them the folks at the Wildlife Medical Clinic at the U of I College of Vet Medicine. So we want to say thanks to them for making it possible for us to have her on the show. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's a caller to talk with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
There was some phrase, I think, that the guest used, talking about brothers and sisters and our relationship to animals. And to me, it's not at all surprising that we thought of animals as more apart from us than we are, because than they actually are evolutionarily, because we didn't have the means to measure certain things for a long time. But then also, even in the human world, brothers and sisters and feeling like you're all part of the same group doesn't occur easily among different nationalities or tribes. There's always the other. The world is, in my view, built on exploitation. It can be fairly mild exploitation or not. And we've always used animals and exploited them or enjoyed them. And I think that in some ways we're going overboard these days with thoughts of animals' discomfort. And I mean, we shouldn't go out of our way to pick on animals, and we should not destroy them wantonly. But they're not humans, and even if there were humans, we'd probably exploit them anyway. So that's my point.
All right. Well, can you react to?
Yeah. Any comments on that? Well, the caller, you're not alone in that thinking about how in the world. I'm paraphrasing here. Can we take care of humans and animals together? And we exploit, or another way that I say it, we must harm to survive. And that happens in families. It happens in across species. It happens to environments. So you're true in saying that exploitation is part of how we survive and how we get around in the world. And what I want to lift up is the possibility that we also evolve to collaborate, and that there is the miracle that we can perhaps take care of humans in an ever greater ability, and perhaps non-humans as well. But we must always keep in mind that we're here to survive, and that means harm does come to other beings. And my question, or my dare, is can we reduce that harm in our lives? Can we find a way to perhaps move to a more plant-based diet so one less cow dies a year and suffers in a feedlot? I'm not talking about that we can live totally without harm, but may we reduce it? Can we open our hearts enough, learn enough, measure enough to say one less beautiful animal will suffer less because of what I've done this year?
Okay. Well, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's again an email from someone who writes, "I think that your guest is brilliant in her understanding of this issue and would love to know how she handles these discussions when she comes in contact with those who don't see a problem with how things are. I guess my question is, what is the best way to approach this with those who immediately tune out as soon as the word environmental is mentioned?"
Truly, truly. Sounds like you've had experience with that. I also work a lot in, I'm going to use the word right now because you'll understand it, animal rights and advocacy. So let me just say, so that's very much true in that area as well. And again, what I do is I listen to people. You know, I'm not there to tell them what I feel, because if they don't feel empathized with, if they don't feel like they're on my team, they're not going to hear my message and my experiences either. So if I have the energy on a given day, I ask them why they think like they do. What are their experiences? What are their underlying needs? And I connect with them. And it may take us a year of those kinds of conversations before I can start working with a colleague to say, well, how are we going to meet both of our needs? So it's really hard to talk to people when you're not open to being changed yourself. And so I believe it's that holy other, being with the totally open to how you could be changed in a conversation, that actually opens the way for someone else to be changed based on what you say. And it's not easy, because there's a lot of anger about the harm and destruction in our world. And so it's not easy to listen. I want to point that out as well.
Well, how, you know, I think that once you start putting some terminology like animal rights on the table, then things are going to start to get difficult. And I think that the difficulty, I suppose, some people have is that once you start down that road, where do you say, okay, we've gone far enough? Mm-hmm. And do you end up having to get to some point where you say, and I'm not necessarily suggesting that this is what I think, but opening it up for discussion, do you have to get to some point where you say, yes, there is a functional moral equivalency between human animals and non-human animals? And then if you do that, if you get to that point, then that raises all kinds of questions about how you're going to relate to other species.
Well, boy, we're just focusing right in on the dilemma of all of our lives. How do we live with making decisions that are complicated and someone gets harmed somewhere down the line based on the decisions that we make? And so you're saying, if we make an absolute moral decision, how are we going to live with the complexity and the outcome? Like right now, they're trying to legislate that we can't have primates, the great apes used in research right now. And if we start with them, is it going to lead down the road? And what I want to say about that the piece that could help us there is knowing, one, we must harm to survive, and two, just to be aware of the needs of other animals and other individuals. It doesn't mean we have to act 100% perfect like our expectations would be. Because let me remind you that, or all of us and myself, that moral decisions are cultural constructs. It was not immoral to have slaves in the Hebrew scriptures or even 200 years ago in this country. So we construct what is morally right or not right. There is no absolute saying thou shalt not kill a fish to have your tribe survive. So how do we as humans, and I'm trying to be clear here, how do we live with, there is no absolute line of what you should and should not do. All there is the beauty and the pain and the suffering of the other. And how do we keep open to that so we can minimize that harm? We humans want us to draw the line and say, here's how I'm going to make decisions. And what I try to do is give people the tools to have the social and emotional intelligence to not live by rules, but by live by presence of heart and understanding to constantly refine our behavior.
Yeah. Something I think that is really quite interesting to watch is the extent to which people of faith are coming to talk more about, think more about, become more active around environmental issues, and how it's something that seems to transcend the political identification of those individuals. I mean, and to the extent that, you know, we have this idea, well, you know, environmentalists, they're all a bunch of liberals. Well, the fact of the matter is there are people who identify themselves as pretty conservative people of faith who also say, well, we're very concerned about the environment too. You know, stewardship is stewardship, and it doesn't, you know, you can't say it stops at one point along the political divide. And I think that that's really interesting. I'm not sure how much momentum something like that has. But I wonder if you've experienced that kind of thing, say maybe coming together with other people of other people of faith who might not see eye to eye on other kinds of issues, but this particular one is something that can bring people together.
Sure, we stick together on common ground. We may not be eye to eye on right to life, for instance, or homosexuality and marriage, and we may not see eye to eye on that, but we choose our common ground. And I have been involved in a number of movements where we need to support each other and stick together, and saying that there is an interconnecting beauty and majesty and wonder and awe, and every faith tradition talks about that differently. But we see the world around us, and what are we going to do each in our individual ways to bring that message of healing and hope to the people that we work with, each in our different ways. So the animal advocacy movements and the environmental movements see religion or spirituality as one of the many tools of human dimensions that can be used to help people feel that interconnection and belonging and hence change their behavior.
Mm. Maybe about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus. I guess should introduce again our guest, Dr. Laura Kim Joyner. She is a doctor of veterinary medicine. She has done a lot of work in avian medicine and conservation, particularly in the Philippines and Latin America. She is also an ordained Unitarian minister and is interested in the kinds of things we're talking about here this morning. In fact, she gave a talk on the campus last night on this, dealing with, I'm sure, a lot of these issues, talking about human dimensions of conservation, how to put the human animals into the equation when you're talking about environmental preservation. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you want, will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe I'm just convinced, I know we sort of bounced around here, but I'm interested in going back and having you talk a little bit more about this the increasing idea that first of all, that animals do think and they do have emotions, and that if you spend enough time watching them in their native environment, just going about their thing, that you can actually learn something about what they are thinking and feeling by careful watching. What sort of things do you think have been learned? Say, just, you know, your thing is parrots. Mm-hmm. So I suppose I imagine you spend a lot of time just watching parrots do their thing.
That's right. And I was not trained as a behaviorist or a cognitive ethologist, but it's true. I spent years, you know, 12 hours a day out watching parrots. And I didn't quantitate it, but I had an understanding of the complexity of parrots that have dialects. You move from one side of the volcano to the other, and they have a different language. You know, crows have some 200 or 300 words. Dogs have 1,000 words, you know, within the human language. It's very complex. And so I had a sort of a gestalt, a sense that so much more was going on, even though it hadn't been quantitated yet. It's hard to get behaviorist money to study in these areas and see the animals. But I was able to see that they have complex hierarchical societies. They talk a lot. They play a lot. They think a lot. So much so in seeing the complexity of their behaviors that when I came back to this country to work in clinical avian medicine, I would look at birds in cages here or hand-raised in these cages, and I couldn't see hardly any corresponding behavior what their wild counterparts would be like. It was very reduced behavioral responses and complexity. And so this is perhaps the biggest message, is that to take care of our birds in our homes and in zoos, we really need to do the wild bird research to know how we should structure our environments to give them the life, or to ask the question, maybe they shouldn't even be in captivity in the first place.
Mm-hmm. All right. A couple of callers here. How about we'll go next to talk with someone in Mahomet, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I hope I didn't miss you already discussing this, but 60 Minutes, I think it was, the other day, had this article on farms in Texas where they have exotic animals running around, and they actually invite people down and charge them $45,000 to shoot a Cape buffalo, and there were different prices on different animals. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I started watching it, I thought, oh, that's so disgusting. The whole idea of going down there and shooting an animal that's almost, you know, on the edge of extinction is repugnant to me. But by the end of the article, I had sort of changed my mind, because some of those animals they have down there, as so they were saying, are either almost extinct or extinct in the wild in Africa. And yes, they don't belong in Texas, but maybe one of these days Africa will get to the point where the people in Texas can send some back to repopulate areas. You know, it's like either be on a farm in Texas and let a few of you get shot to pay for the farm, or go extinct, and that's not much of a choice. He had about 6,000 of this kind of oryx that was almost extinct in the wild in Africa. I'll let you talk about it. He really changed my mind. Thank you.
All right. Well, that kind of is the mm-hmm. argument, not so much for something like that, but that really is the argument, I think, has been the argument for zoos and for wildlife parks for such a long time, that they may be, maybe they are playing a kind of a conservation preservation role if those animals are threatened in the wild.
Right, and to comment on that, David, as well as what the caller said, I just want to lift up your courageousness to listen to a program that turned you off and was disgusting, and how you were open to the views and the experience and learning more. I think that's a valuable piece of moral discussions with non-human animals. Really want to lift that up. And I want to go back to the people issue. There are, for every different animal in a different location, there are different solutions based on the people. And so some animals and birds, their lives have been saved on this planet by bringing animals into captivity, and individuals have suffered because of that. And sometimes those really hard decisions happen. However, if you don't find a way for the people to flourish where these animals naturally roam, then we're not going to ever be able to put them back. So we need to say, yes, we can bring animals here and shoot them, but we need intensive projects and understanding to build up the communities where those animals will be. And finally, what I want to say is 20 years ago, we thought we knew the answers to conservation. You know, pristine habitat, don't poach the birds, don't shoot them, don't do this. Now it's so complex and urgent. For myself, nothing is off the table. Mm-hmm. And so although I may not be a hunter of mammals, I, like you, want to listen because I don't know what the solution's going to be. And I want to minimize harm as I do it. But I want to be open to that. And just for as parrots go, it's very difficult to take birds that have been taken out of their country and released back into their home countries. We have such a sharing of diseases and mixing that argument for at least parrots in the United States is it would be very risky to transport birds back here to their home country.
Well, do you think I have a couple of calls I promise to try to get to them. But do you think, though, with the kind of so often in the kind of conservation we're talking about, that really the big answer is ecotourism, that is trying to persuade people that they should be preserving their environment because one way they can generate income is by having other people come and see it?
Yes, ecotourism is a standard response to conservation these days. It's not the only answer, but you also want to be building that up at the same time. We also need to do things like carbon footprint and carbon offset. Mm-hmm. These resources bring us money, whether we extract them or not, for our own economy. So we need to find a way to put resources and money back in for what we take out. And ecotourism is one of those ways.
Okay. A couple other callers here. Effingham, line 4 is our next caller. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Can your guest explain why Homo sapiens kill one another in the volumes that they do, and why? Thank you.
That may be a little beyond the scope of this program. And I don't know. You have any? You even want to? Even want to go near that?
in 30 seconds or less. Let me just say that's the question, isn't it? Last night in the presentation, I said, really, what we're talking about, are humans basically good or basically bad? You know, that's the question we always ask, and we try to figure out how we can do that. And that's a great question. So my response to that is we kill others of our kind because we evolved to do so. We're great apes out of the savannas, and this is how we survive, to be competitive and to put down the neighboring tribe, and it's why our genes flourish to this day. But I want to lift up that other animals kill their own kind, kill their own infants, kill juveniles, have wars such as the chimpanzees in Africa. We are not alone in this, nor are we alone in loving animals of a different species. So, yes, we kill each other, but we also save each other.
Okay. One more caller. Line 2, Champagne. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to reprise what you started with and your experiences in Latin and Central America and the tie between the environment and the indigenous people. And this is a question that the campus is seized with in a way, because there's a Millercom series, Sovereignty and Autonomy in the Western Hemisphere, and it has a dimension about the indigenous struggles throughout the region in post-colonial Latin America. So it'd be nice to have one of those speakers on, since I can't make it to them. But so I I think you'll probably understand what I'm getting at, and I thought that was a really salient thing, the tie between the environment, the indigenous people, and the animals, and well, also just the vegetation as well, just saving. All right.
Sure.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Sure. Indigenous rights is one of the ways to do conservation work, is to work for the people, and so they can be present and live on sustainable habitats.
We're at the point, we have maybe about a minute left, and enough time certainly for me to say thanks. And if people are interested in finding out more about you and about Lefebvre Conservation and Wildlife, there's a lot of stuff on the web. I think maybe the easiest thing might be just to put your name into their search engine and look for you, Laura Kim. That's one word, Laura Kim Joyner, and you'll find her and a lot of information about the things that she's involved with. So if you want to find out more about her and you have internet access, you can do that. What sort of last thought would you like to leave with folks?
I think the last thought that I would like to leave with is the human dimension piece of what we're capable of. I just want to respond to how smart and intuitive you've been, David, and also the callers. Mm-hmm. So right here, we have experienced what it's going to take if we are going to live good lives and help other animals live good lives too. So I'm feeling very grateful right now. And come on, team, human team, we
go
can
humans.
Do this.
Our guest, Laura Kim Joyner, she's consulted and worked in avian medicine and conservation, particularly in the Philippines and Latin America. She's currently director of Lefebvre Conservation, director of One Earth Conservation. She is adjunct professor at North Carolina State University College of Veterinary Medicine here, visiting her visit and sponsored in part by the fine folks at the Wildlife Medical Clinic at the University of Illinois College of Vet Medicine. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.